Surratt Art Studios, I welcome you to Surratt Cinema. I want to begin this evening by thanking our co-sponsors. I especially want to acknowledge David Hustis. He's worked long and hard with the students on the Surratt Studio Art Committee to host and plan this event. I'd also like to thank Bridget Cohnhorst and the Surratt Visual Arts Committee. They are our co-sponsors of the reception that you all enjoyed prior to coming here. There are also a number of departments here at the university that were very involved in bringing you this event, so I'd like to acknowledge them. The Department of Art and Art History, the Department of English, Department of History, American and Southern Studies, Vanderbilt University Center for Teaching, Vanderbilt University Fine Arts Gallery, the Department of Women's and Gender Studies. The generous support of these university departments has made this evening possible. Tonight, my role is to introduce our speaker. I'm Joelle Lobodice, Director of Student Art Programs here at Vanderbilt University. And I'm also our participant as a community artist in the Chancellor's Artist in Residence Program, titled Judy Chicago and Donald Woodman, a Multimedia Project of Discovery. I know, it's a long title, but it is a groundbreaking program that brings together two nationally known artists and an art historian to work with 12 undergraduates here at Vanderbilt and 13 artists in the community, and many of them are out in the audience tonight. We are all working on projects that explore content-based art making. As part of this artist in residence program, Vivian is collaborating with Judy and Donald by leading a weekly seminar on art history, theory, and gender construction. As students in the class, we are being challenged in our creative pursuits. Both Judy, Donald, and Vivian are directly involved in stimulating our intellectual curiosity and encouraging us to apply critical thinking to our art-making process. This evening, Vivian will introduce us to the collaborative work by Judy and Donald, as well as share her experience and perspective on this unique residency program. It's an honor to introduce Vivian, my friend, my colleague, my mentor, and now my teacher. To give you a little background, Vivian is a professor of art history, American studies, women and gender studies here at Vanderbilt University. Having received her BA and MA degree from Ohio State University and her PhD from University of Wisconsin-Madison, she is an esteemed member of the Vanderbilt faculty since 1985. During her tenure, she has published numerous articles in art journals, presented papers at conferences, and lectured at universities and museums throughout the United States. She has authored two books, Art and the Crisis of Marriage, Georgia O'Keeffe and Edward Hopper, as well as Art and Empire, The Politics of Ethnicity in the United States Capitol. Her current research in art explores the area of rape and sexual abuse. She has two books in progress, The Ghosting of Sexual Violence, Rape and Incest in 19th Century American Art, and Feminist Art and Sexual Trauma, Ending the Silence in Contemporary American Art. Before Vivian takes the stage, I'd like to remind everyone that immediately following the presentation, you're invited to stay as we have a question and answer session with Judy, Donald, and Vivian. So please, everyone, join me as we welcome Dr. Vivian Green Free and her talk, Intersecting Lives, Judy Chicago and Donald Woodman in Collaboration.
What a great introduction. I am delighted to be here. I can't see anybody out there. I guess that's okay.
Bring the lights up, Vivian. Up just a little bit.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Yeah, I don't like not seeing anybody. I'm delighted to be here this evening and to have the opportunity and honor to work with Judy and Donald on this project, as well as the honor and excitement to be working with the 26 students who are in the class. I first met Judy and Donald a little over 2 years ago now, when they came here for an exhibition of the At Home Project. Judy and Donald had facilitated a semester-long course at Western Kentucky University entitled At Home and Kentucky Project in 2002. And I, in fact, had gone to see the exhibition. It was only a two-hour drive away from Nashville, Tennessee. I teach a course on art since 1935, and I thought, ooh, I get to see the newest thing that Judy and Donald have been involved in. So I went to see the At Home Project, and I was unbelievably impressed with the experience, the art, the content. And when I went to see the At Home Project, I already knew I was going to be writing a book about domestic violence, rape, and incest in American art, but I did not realize that the At Home Project was going to give me a chapter for my book. I went back, in fact, a number of times to see the exhibition. It was really quite exciting. So Judy and Donald were asked to come to Vanderbilt in order to have an exhibition here of the At Home Project, and at that time I had an opportunity to meet them. And we began discussing the possibility of their coming here to teach a course and my collaborating with them. So Gordon Gee is not able to be here this evening, but I want to also acknowledge him and Constance, because they really are the ones responsible for bringing Judy and Donald here and for giving all of us the opportunity to be involved in this very exciting project. I'm going to be talking some more about the At Home Project, but I do want to point out that the idea of taking a house and having students transform it into a series of art installations had a precedent. Judy Chicago, along with Miriam Shapiro, had collaborated in 30 years previously to the At Home Project in the 1970s in turning a building, a home, into an art environment. And at that time, the students dealt with the concept of the home as a domestic space, and in particular, ways in which women were trapped in that domestic space. And of course, it fits in with the second wave of feminism and the issues that were being addressed at that particular period of time. I do want to talk about the At Home Project, and I do want to talk about the project that I'm involved in right now, which is so much fun. But before I do that, I thought I'd give you just a little bit of background about Judy and Donald. And of course, I'm not going to be able to give either of their careers justice. Judy is most well known for The Dinner Party, which dates from 1974 to 1979. And I'm realizing the difference between my giving my lecture this time as opposed to 2 years ago, because 2 years ago I didn't know Judy and Donald. And it was the first time in my life that I gave a lecture about an artist and had the artist in the audience. And I didn't know, do I talk about them? When I give a lecture about an artist, I always refer to them as their last name, Chicago Woodman. So here I am, it's just natural, Judy and Donald. Anyway, Judy is the most well-known for The Dinner Party, dating, as I said, from 1974 to 1979. It was exhibited at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art in 1979, and it is an enormous project of three equilateral tables forming a triangle, 46 by 6 feet in size, so it really is quite big. And as you can see here, the table is covered with plates, and I'm going to show you a couple of details, as well as place settings, and we have a total of place settings for 39 women artists, including writers, sculptors, painters, mythological figures, and historical figures. When Judy did the Dinner Project, first of all, it's a collaborative project. She worked with hundreds of women in order to create this incredibly elaborate and very important work of art. And the women helped her in terms of doing a lot of the embroidery, for example, of doing the plates, etc. And Judy is really the facilitator of the project, and mostly it's her ideas for each of the plates and the ideas behind the plates. The idea of working in collaboration, which we're doing in the project right now, is definitely linked to the feminist movement of the 1970s, in which women artists like Judy were arguing against the concept of the single, solitary, male author slash genius working in isolation, and now instead we have women working together and collaborating. And I'll be talking about the significance that the At Home project and the Multimedia Project of Discovery is a project that includes men and what the significance of that is. But in the 1970s, it was all women. I'm showing you here the fertility goddess. There were various plates dedicated to goddesses in order to reject the Judeo-Christian worship of the unitary male god. And I'm showing you the plate for Georgia O'Keeffe, who is now a very well-known artist, but in the 1970s she wasn't. In fact, in the 1970s, when I was an undergraduate at Ohio State University, women were not included in the survey class, they weren't included in the survey textbooks, so that Judy's dinner party is really, really significant because she was at the forefront of feminists who were interested in reinserting women into history and finding all of those forgotten women who, in fact, had been artists or writers, etc., and giving us information about them, not only in the dinner party as an art project, but also in a book that she has published. The other thing that's very significant, and of course there's a whole lot more I could be saying about this, about the dinner party, is that in this work, Judy introduced what is referred to as central core or vaginal iconography, and that is each plate has a circular rhythmical form that evokes central core imagery, the crevices of a woman's vulva, contractions of an orgasm, to locate female sexuality as a locus of vulnerability and power from which women's creativity flows. So it's a very important iconography that many women in the 1970s then began to address. The dinner party has pretty much not been exhibited, and it has been exhibited periodically in different locations, but it has been in storage most of the time since the 1970s. But it is going to be permanently installed next year, next spring, a year from now, at the Brooklyn Museum in New York. There is going to be the Feminist Art Gallery sponsored by the Elizabeth A. Sackler Foundation. So, yes! And if you want to read something incredibly moving, you want to read Judy's second autobiography, Beyond the Flower, in which she talks about the experience of the critical response to the dinner party and how hard it has been to have the dinner party permanently installed. And I have to say that for me, being a person from the 1970s, a student in the 1970s, who knew about the dinner party and knew about Judy's work, it was so important to me. I took the very first women's studies course ever offered at Ohio State University. And of course, we were talking about Judy's work and Judy. It was so significant. And the fact that it's taken so long for this to find a permanent location is astonishing. And the fact that it's going to be permanently located in the Brooklyn Museum is wonderful. So everybody needs to go to Brooklyn in order to see it. I could spend a lot more time talking about Judy's art, but I thought I would just really give you the dinner party as an example and then give you some information about Donald Woodman. Donald is a photographer who had studied with Minor White, worked in the Sacramento Peak Solar Observatory doing sophisticated scientific photography and solar observations, and also doing creative photography. I'm just going to show you two works from a series that he has done that are incredibly powerful. I had an opportunity in August to go down to Mexico to visit Jeannie and Donald, where they live in this unbelievable old hotel that they've renovated. And Donald had his photographs up from this series and also from the series with his psychiatrist that are incredible, very, very powerful works. These are large, very, very large photographs in which he is focusing, and I'm just showing you two, the hyper-masculinity of the Western cowboy as spectacle for Eastern dudes, focusing also upon the myth of the West, its speed, often in a blurry, off-center, frenetic works of art. Jeannie and Donald met and had a whirlwind romance, decided to get married, and in getting married, decided that they were going to get married by a Jewish rabbi because they both are Jews. But they're both secular Jews. And what happened is that they, in deciding to get married with a rabbi, started to dwell into their background as Jews, and they became fascinated with the Holocaust. Today I went for a hike around Redwood Lake, and I was thinking about my talk today. And I was thinking that when I met Judy, I remember telling her, boy, I identified with her so much, and I feel in many ways our lives parallel one another. Although I'm an art historian, and she's an artist, and we're finding that there are differences and connections definitely between our two disciplines. At any rate, as I was hiking, I was thinking about Judy telling us in her books about her background, that she is from Chicago, and hence she changed her name to Judy Chicago, from Judy Cohen, that she comes from a long tradition of rabbinical dads, grandfathers, great-grandfathers, going back I don't know how many generations of Orthodox rabbis, that her father was a secular Jew who became very active in the Marxist movement and in liberal, in various liberal causes. And Judy, as well as Donald, were brought up as not knowing a whole lot about their Judaism. And when they decided to get married and they learned more about their Jewish heritage, they began to think about the Holocaust, and for them it was fascinating to really be thinking about the Holocaust. And the way in which that connects to me is, I also was raised as a secular Jew, but my mother is a survivor of the Holocaust from Berlin. And so for me, the Holocaust has been an omnipresent cloud that has affected us in so many ways. So I was thinking about that. At any rate, Judy and Donald decided to collaborate on a project, and they worked on this project between 1985 and 1993, which is entitled The Holocaust Project: From Darkness into Light. It is a 3,000 square foot traveling exhibition that combines painting and photography. Judy and Donald had, upon deciding to work on the Holocaust Project, they did a lot of research. And one of the things that I want to say about both Judy and Donald is they are scholars in their own right. Judy is revising her book about the dinner party, and she's doing an incredible amount of research on the artist. And of course, a lot more material exists now than when she first wrote her book about the dinner party. So they did a lot of research. They traveled to various concentration camps and massacre sites in Germany, France, Austria, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Soviet Union, and Israel. And they decided to focus on the human aspects of the events, not just the Jewish experience, by creating paintings based on photographs on photo linen. Donald combined photographs made by himself with documentary records made by Nazis, prisoners being carried off to camps in cattle cars, prisoners who have committed suicide by flinging themselves against electrified barbed wire, etc. And Judy altered the photos with spray acrylic silk screening or hand coloring photos. And I'll show you a really good example of this right here. You can see her painting above, and then one of these photographs that's been altered located below. Very powerful work. The project is intended as a journey into darkness of the Holocaust and out into the light of hope. It enabled both Judy and Donald to explore the Jewish heritage and also enabled Judy to combine this interest in her Jewish heritage with feminist concerns. So that in this work, Double Jeopardy, and I'm just showing you one from a whole series dealing with this concept, you're seeing a contrast between what the women were doing during the Holocaust versus what the men were doing during the Holocaust. And one of the things that Judy and Donald noticed is that so many people who wrote about the Holocaust really didn't talk about the women's experience during the Holocaust, and their interest was to reinsert women into that experience, just as Judy had reinserted women into the history of art history, literature, etc., in the dinner party. The Holocaust project ends with the Rainbow Shabbat, a large-scale stained glass work. It's a triptych in the center, and I'm showing you the center panel right now. We see a Jewish Sabbath male as an image of international sharing across race, gender, class lines. You also notice that everybody is looking to the right. Here we're looking at the woman. And of course, the work of art has an allusion to the Last Supper. A lot of people, a lot of feminists in the 1970s were saying things about the Last Supper. But where are the women? Well, where are the women? They're having a Shabbat meal for Passover, and the women were the ones who were cooking and who were serving, etc. But when you see the Last Supper, like Leonardo da Vinci's, I'm sorry to bring it in, there are no women who are present. It's just Christ and his apostles. So Judy and Donald are clearly reinserting women into that history, but also making it clear that there are other religions and other nationalities, other ethnicities, etc., all of whom come together, and they're very much interested in making a statement about the need for all these different kinds of people from different walks of life to become unified and to come together. The Holocaust Project also was very clear in making statements that the Holocaust is not the only atrocity that has happened in our lifetime, and that atrocities continue to occur, unfortunately. They worked on the Holocaust Project together for a number of years, and then Judy in particular went back to teaching. She had taught at Cal Arts, as I said, working on the Woman's House, a semester-long course with Miriam Shapiro in the early 1970s. She went back to teaching after doing the Holocaust Project and taught at universities and colleges throughout the United States, including Duke, Indiana, UNC Chapel Hill, and Pitzer College of Claremont. She and Donald then collaborated upon the At Home Project at Western Kentucky University, who had invited them to reconsider the subject of the home through a collaborative project with students who would again transform a domestic dwelling into an art environment. And let me show you what the house looked like. This is what the house looked like from the outside. Once again, like Woman's House, the rooms replicated the conventional areas of the house while they challenged the activity of that room and the meaning of that activity. So I want to take you into the home and just show you a few of the rooms. But before I do that, I do want to return to the point I had made earlier. And that is, I had said that I think it's really significant that for the At Home Project and for the Multimedia Project of Discovery here at Vanderbilt, no longer is Judy collaborating with just a woman, she's collaborating with a man, that is Donald, and the students in both classes are men and women, whereas in the Woman House in the early 1970s at Cal Arts, it was only women. Well, that is an appropriate way of showing the way in which the feminist movement in women's studies has changed. For example, here at Vanderbilt University, we have a women's studies department, and just this year, the title of it was changed from women's studies to women and gender studies. That is, in the 1980s, the men's movement evolved. It was very much influenced by the women's movement, the second wave of women feminists, in which men began to ask similar questions. Well, wait a minute. We've been talking about ways in which women are constructed, what the expectations are in terms of women, how they're tied into the home. But men also have these expectations that society places upon them. And of course, Donald is dealing that in the rodeo series that I was showing you. So the collaboration of a man and a woman in teaching this course and the collaboration of men and women in the class that we're teaching now and of the at-home project is very significant, and it fits in with the time period in which we currently live. Let me take you into the home. I'm just going to show you a couple of the spaces. I'm showing you here The Heart of the Home Kitchen by Alice Noel, in which the suggestion is that the kitchen is the center of the home, the domestic space where the wife slash mother feels trapped and chained to her domestic duties of supplying foods for nutrients at the same time. And here's another view of the kitchen. Unfortunately, this is one of the really sad things. The woman's house no longer exists, and the at-home project doesn't exist, so they haven't torn down the building, right? They have. They've torn down the building. They torn down the building. Anyway, so all the works of art I'm showing you no longer exist. And the project that our students are going to be doing at the Cone Building, which I'll tell you some more about, is also only going to be up for 2 weeks and it's no longer going to exist. You'll have to see it before it's taken down. This is the Eating Disorders Bathroom by Katie Grone and Lindsay Lee. That function as a space for bulimics to vomit, and that contains such products as Slim Fast, Diet Coke, weight loss shake, as well as various books. You can't see the books on various diets. And I remember looking in this space and seeing a book, Fat is a Feminist Issue, and I remember in the 1970s reading that book for the first time, Second Wave of Feminism, being in a consciousness-raising group, dealing with all the issues connected with that as a feminist issue, and there's that book, so it still is an important book today. But certainly the idea of eating disorders was not something that was included in the woman's house, because in the 1970s, eating disorders was really not paid attention to. Now it's an epidemic, unfortunately, on campus and elsewhere, and it's not only affecting women, but it's also starting to affect a lot of men. So the Eating Disorders Bathroom was appropriately addressing this topic, which is very important for our culture at this particular period of time. The Now and Then Living Room, which I'm showing to you, was a living room, but the really fascinating aspect, for me at least, when I went to see it, was this section, which is referred to as the media wall. It's filled with 6 television screens that continuously play different sarcastically constructed commercials derived from real life with their own soundtracks, and really quite amusing. So in the original woman's house, when you went into the living room, there was no television. In the 1970s, we had TVs, but not as much as we do now. And in some homes, I mean, in our house, we've got 3 TVs. Who needs 3 TVs now that I think about it? That's absurd. For 3 people in one house, we have 3 TVs. That's pretty bad. So you have all these TVs, and you have no idea how obsessed we are with TVs in our culture. But the commercials were commercials of, we were looking at an advertisement of a woman by a car. And rather than telling you what the commercial would be saying, the voiceover would say something like, look at this sexy body, I know you want to have my body, and you think if you buy this car, you can be able to go to bed with me, yada, yada, yada. It was really very, very amusing and very well done. The spaces, the installations that were the most important for me for the work that I'm doing right now are 3 installations that deal with the subjects of domestic violence, incest, and rape. I'm showing you The Abuse Closet by Frida Fairchild. It was located within the master bedroom, suggesting that often there are secrets that are hidden in closets in families that people do not address, such as domestic violence. And here you have a poster in which you see this very, very attractive woman, and it's only upon looking clear closely, here you can see she's got a black eye, that you start seeing that they've got bruised bodies, and the writing on here is saying things like, you know, thank goodness for these glasses, nobody can see underneath my eye, and other things like that. In the closet were dresses with writing on it and shoes on the floor. And one shoe, for example, said, oh, these high heels, I can't, they're not good for me to run away from him when he tries to hurt me. One of the things on the poster says, you know, my husband beat me, he's saying he's sorry, is it my fault? He's telling me it's my fault. And that's very often, unfortunately, the kind of thinking process that an abused person would process when something like that happens. So it was an amazingly powerful installation. The other installation, which was incredible, is The Nightmare Nursery by Kevin Baker and Nancy Turner. You walked into this very oppressive dark space upon which there was a bed. There are these foot steps located here, large ones, and a wooden hand, you can probably see a part of it here. And then written on the wall, which you can't see, are words like, help me, mommy, mommy, help me. And on the wall, you can see here, ugly and other things like that, shut up, stupid. So it clearly is a room in which incest has taken place. And one of the things that I was very struck by is the fact that you don't know if it's a boys' room or if it's a girls' room. It's making it very clear that incest is not biased in terms of whether you're a boy or a girl. And again, I can't tell you how amazingly effective this space was. As was the Rape Garage, in which a number of students collaborated, Stephanie Bruiser, Josh Edwards, and Katie Brown, as well as Lindsay Lee, and you can see photographs of them here. It was the garage, an appropriate space to have this because it was separate from the house, but a part of the house, just like, you know, something like rape takes place that is not talked about. And there was this amazing bed filled with an array of pornographic images, making it clear that there's a connection between pornography and rape. The things that you see along here are weapons, that phallic weapons that were used to hurt a person. And the wall with the photographs had statistics and other information about the number of women who were raped, the number of older women who were raped, men who were raped. And in fact, Josh Edwards, who includes himself here, was a very proud person who came forward and talked about his having been raped by a girl. It's the last taboo. I mean, one taboo is we don't talk about rape. The second taboo is we don't talk about incest. Those are the big secrets. We're not allowed to talk about them. It's not appropriate to talk about them. But another taboo, and the last taboo, was that men have also been abused in some fashion, and they're now just starting to talk about it. And Josh is one of those people who began talking about it. So Judy and Donald facilitated the students who did this, and I remember that when I gave my talk 2 years ago and spoke to Judy and Donald about the project we're doing here, I kept talking about teaching the course. And Judy and Donald would say, no, we're not teaching the class, we're facilitating the class. Like, oh, okay. Remember, facilitating. I now understand very clearly we are not teaching the class, we are facilitating the class. And I now understand very clearly how they were engaged with the students in helping them formulate their ideas. So let me tell you a little bit about our class. And the students are here, so if everybody would stand up in the class for one moment, and can we turn on the lights for a second so you can see the participants? Come on, stand up, stand up. They deserve an applause. In fact, can you put the lights on there? Because I don't it's fascinating. When I showed Judy the chapter I had written about the at-home project, and she read it, she said to me, "No, I don't do consciousness raising. I do circle-based pedagogy." And she explained to me that circle-based pedagogy is in which she combines the circle format of consciousness raising with managed group dynamics, interceding when necessary to move an individual in a certain direction or to assist with awareness of personal issues. I now really understand what they mean by that, because we have formed that circle a number of times, and a number of times we have gone in the circle and the students have talked about, they talked about themselves. It was self-presentations. They talked about themselves. They talked about their childhoods. They talked about their experiences in terms of creating art. And I must say that for me, it was fascinating because I looked at the applications, Judy McDonald looked at the applications, and we did not know the diversity of students we were going to have. We knew we were going to have men and women, and we wanted men and women. We knew we were going to have artists from Vanderbilt and artists from the community, and we wanted to have that. We did not know that we were going to have students from the ages of 18 to 60. We did not know that we were going to have one student who's from Japan, another student who's from the Philippines, another student whose parents are from Lebanon and Ecuador and has spent time in both countries, another person who is from Calcutta, India. We didn't know that we have a couple of Asian Americans for whom their Korean background is very, very significant. We didn't know that we were going to have three men who are openly gay and one woman who is openly a lesbian. We didn't know, those are the things that we didn't know, and it came out in the time that they were talking about themselves. And one of the things that I find is, I think that everybody in the class feels comfortable to start opening up and sharing very intimate things, and I want to thank you for trusting us to do that. And I'm reading their journals, and for trusting me to read your journals and to be able to read what you're talking about. Because it is very personal information that's going on here. But Judy and Donald are really, really incredibly successful in terms of getting students to the participants. I'm not supposed to use the word student, the participants. It's clicking. the participants to really think about, well, okay, what do they want to do for their art? How does their art relate to their lives? What is the content going to be of their art? How are they going to convey that content formalistically in the work of art that they create? And how is the viewer going to understand the meaning of the artwork? And I find that really fascinating, to be watching the process as it evolves. What's different between this project and the at-home project, the at-home project had a pre-planned theme, and the theme was they were going to once again explore the idea of the home and turn the home into these various installations. Our project, we had determined that we weren't going to have a predetermined theme. We were going to allow the participants to decide the themes that they were going to want to work on. And we didn't know if they were going to decide to work together on one theme or if they were going to come up with different themes. So what has happened is that a series of themes have evolved. They include religion, an amazing number of people who are going to be dealing with religion, Christianity, but also Eastern religions. In fact, there's going to be a space in which Eastern and Western religions are going to be located in the same space. And it's going to be very, very exciting. Gender and sexuality is going to be a theme. Family, as I said, a number of people have opened up about families. Everybody comes from a troubled family. That's what I'm learning. And it's incredibly powerful to hear everybody share their stories about their families. Rape is going to be a subject, and for those of you who are working on the subject of rape, I hope you feel comfortable if I include it in my book, and if you don't, you have to let me know, because I, you know, I already told my editor, okay, I have something to add here. Interracial relationships between a Korean American woman and an African American man, and the whole idea of race being an issue within those two cultures. Control is another theme that's evolving. Politics is going to be a theme. Female friendships, which is going to be called femme fatale, or femme fatale, fatal femme, fatal women. And illness is going to be another topic that is going to be dealt with. So Judy and Donald had told the participants on the first day that we're meeting in the Cohen Building. The Cohen Building is located in the Peabody campus, and it's where the studio used to be, but now that they have their own gorgeous, incredibly wonderful building that if you haven't seen, you have to go look at, and I have to admit I'm jealous about it. They used to be over in the Cohen Building, and the Cohen Building was sort of this, you know, it was in disrepair and, you know, all these problems with the Cohen Building. The Cohen Building is this amazing building. It's a McKim, Mead, and White structure from the turn of the century, well, from the 1920s, really, a neoclassical building that really was intended to be a museum. When I was hired at Vanderbilt 20 years ago, I was told that the Cohen Building was going to be transformed, and they had the plans, into a building for the arts, and it was going to be art history, studio, a museum, and our library. Well, that was 20 years ago. Now the studio people have their own building, and we have our own building, and we still need a building for our museum. So we're hoping that the Cohen Building will be turned into a museum, and it is a gorgeous building. So Judy and Donald told the participants on the first day, what's the square feet? 13,000 square feet. And what they told the participants is, your job for the semester is to fill this entire space with art. The entire space with art. So, on April 21st, we're going to have the opening, and it's going to be up for 3 weeks, and you will be able to go to the Cohen Building and see that 17,000 square feet filled with art projects dealing with these incredible themes. And the artists in the audience are probably thinking, oh my God, I don't have a whole lot of time to do this. But you will accomplish it, and it's going to be fabulous. And you should all feel very, very proud of what you're doing. So I'm going to stop now and give everybody an opportunity to ask Judy and Donald, as well as participants in the audience, any questions they might have. Let me just say one other thing, and that is, this is the first time that Judy and Donald are collaborating with an art historian. So I feel very honored to be doing this, and one of the things that I recognized is that Judy began her pedagogical career, which is what they tried to say in The Hustler, but didn't quite get it across the right way. Judy began her pedagogical career working with another artist, and she has said that this is her last teaching gig. That's a direct quote for her and Donald, in fact, and she is closing it, collaborating with a man and an art historian. So, come on up, and let's open it up to questions from people in the audience.